This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. It's the newest episode of Suspect Convictions. A prominent crime podcaster says she sees the same types of patterns over and over in cases from the 1990s.
You have untested forensic evidence. You have the police kind of making a decision on a suspect and then building a case around that suspect to the exclusion of anybody else. And you have a fairly poor defense.
Rahiba Chowdhury talks about the Bloomington murder case of Christina McNeil on Suspect Convictions. And GLT's Colleen Reynolds checks in on the Multicultural Leadership Program's midterm projects. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's December 1st, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. True crime podcasters compare their cases to that of the murder of Christina McNeil of Bloomington. And on this week's Suspect Convictions, they find some commonalities with other investigations from the 1990s that turn out to have potential holes in them.
The following contains graphic discussions of murder and sexual violence. Listener discretion is advised.
I cannot convey any better the traumatic words that you'd hear on this 911 tape, and when I hear them today, my blood runs cold.
911, what's your emergency?
I need an ambulance. My daughter's dying, I think.
Rescue is needed. Three-year-old female child, unconscious, not breathing.
Wasting away a life in a jail for a murder he didn't commit, and worse, for his own daughter with whom he loved.
There is a whole bunch of evidence now that links Masuk to the crime scene.
There is absolutely no evidence of any forced entry, any breaking in, and according to the defendant, the only people in that house with permission were himself and Christina.
This is Suspect Convictions, a co-production of WGLT Radio and Reader Reporting. I'm Willis Kern, along with Scott Reeder. We've been investigating the mysterious death of three-year-old Christina McNeil, who was found not breathing by her father in their Bloomington, Illinois apartment on June 16, 1998. Martin McNeil was convicted in connection with his daughter's death, though he has alleged since the day after the incident, it was his girlfriend, Masuk Nolan, who was responsible for Christina's death. Years later, Masuk was convicted of murdering her mother-in-law. Today, during Suspect Convictions, we have a couple of guests joining us via Skype. Scott, who do we have with us today?
We got two terrific guests. We have Rahiba Chowdhury and Charlie Worrell. Rahiba is the impetus behind the creation of Serial. She's the person who reached out to NPR to have that podcast created. She's a friend of the family of Adnan Syed. And Charlie is the co-host of Insight Podcast. She co-hosts it with a person from Australia, and they talk about a whole host of different crimes. Undisclosed is the podcast that Rahiba puts out. She does an absolutely awesome job of analyzing a variety of cases of possible wrongful convictions. And they're both among my favorite podcasts to listen to. And very distinctly different, but both are excellent.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Why don't we start, Scott,
sure,
by having each of our guests talk a little bit about their podcast.
Sure.
What is the latest goings on at their end of the world, and they can bring us up to date on that. First, we'll go with Rahiba.
So, we are in our third year of Undisclosed, and we began Undisclosed covering Adnan's case, which was the case at the heart of Serial, the first season. Then we moved on to do other cases that came to us from different innocence projects. One was Joey Watkins out of Georgia. Then we have about four or five of them from the Philadelphia Innocence, from the Pennsylvania Innocence Project, all out of Philly, all from the same era, like the early 90s, when this was just a really horribly common phenomena. And, you know, we one by one have been we've been working with the attorneys on each of these cases. And almost every single one of them is in some various stage of appeal. And so we just wrapped up, I think, two cases out of Philly. We're starting our third one next week. We're doing them in kind of shorter bursts. But these are all defendants who are almost definitely innocent. And we are fairly committed to making sure that there is a process in court that gets them another chance at this. And so that's where we are. But we've gone through maybe about 10 stories so far.
And Charlie, tell us a little bit about your podcast and what's going on there.
Well, Insight, we used to focus mostly on unsolved crimes, but there are only so many that have enough information out there. And, you know, getting FOIA requests on unsolved cases usually get turned down because they're technically open. So we don't often have a lot of information. So we have kind of shifted. We're doing more cases that have been solved or have gone through the court system, but need another look at them, or there's some kind of social issue behind them, like domestic violence or transphobia or something that we want to delve into. Sometimes we just do cases that are interesting to us. Next year, in 2018, we are taking the leap to going to twice a week. So that's the big thing we're prepping for right now. That'll give us a chance to have an extra episode to cover those smaller cases that don't have enough information for a full episode. We've been talking to families and people who are somehow connected to crime, whether their parent committed a crime or their family member was a victim. And so hopefully we'll bring a wider range of stories next year.
One of the things you just brought up, Robbie, is a lot of the crimes that you're looking at on your podcast come from the early 1990s. And It's interesting because this case we're looking at is from the 90s. What are the commonalities you find from that era?
Yeah, I mean, like even with Barton McNeil's case, I am seeing kind of the same types of patterns, which is you have untested forensic evidence. You have the police kind of making a decision on a suspect and then building a case around that suspect to the exclusion of anybody else. And for example, in Adnan's case and many other cases, they won't even take samples or test fingerprints or any other kinds of forensic against other potential suspects. So there's kind of this tunnel vision involved. You have kind of a fairly poor defense. In many of these cases for a variety of reasons. And so there's a bunch of red flags that come at you, but when you, and then in certain jurisdictions, you'll see the same patterns depending on who you're dealing with. So the same, for example, in the Philadelphia series we're doing, the same detectives' names come up over and over and over, and witness coercion pops up in each one of these cases. You end up after many years with witnesses coming forward saying, I was threatened. I was told I had to testify like this, and it was Detective so-and-so, and it's like the same people keep popping up. Or you have prosecutorial misconduct in which, you know, they hide exculpatory evidence. You know, they're supposed to turn it over to the defense, and they don't. But in at the end of the day, it just seems like they just decide this is our guy, and they just ignore everything else, that could mean it, they're wrong.
What creates that mindset in law enforcement? I find it perplexing because I've been working on this season and the prior season, and it does seem like there's a tendency to find your suspect and then try to find the facts that surround the suspect. So, but why do they do that, Robbie?
Well, you know, that's a question that I have asked other law enforcement officers and ex-officers. And another thing I didn't mention in my response earlier is the existence of false confessions, which is also fairly prevalent from that era. Because police were trained in using something called the RAID interrogation technique, which has since been shown to just give you terrible false, you know, statements just because it exhausts witnesses and they end up feeding the witnesses all this information. And, you know, the response I've gotten from law enforcement when I've asked, like, why does this happen? Is that, you know what, they actually really, it's not so much that it's shady or it's deliberately framing somebody who's innocent, but it's that they really just have, they believe they have these gut instincts. They just know it. They don't believe they're doing anything wrong. And many times they don't even realize that they have ended up in the false confession scenario, feeding so much information to this person who then ends up just saying, all right, fine, I did it. And then 20 years ago, 30 years ago, people are like, nobody would confess unless they were really involved.
Charlie, what was your impression when you were listening to the podcast? What really struck you as things that stuck out when you were listening to it?
As far as Masuk goes, some of the things that stuck out to me is that, so the murder she ended up committing with her, you know, when she killed her mother-in-law, it seems so diabolical and so psychopathic, but it seems like she actually has maybe the opposite problem with a instability in her emotions. Like she, instead of not feeling enough, like we would think of a psychopath, she feels everything all the time and too much of it. And I'm wondering if she has a very serious personality disorder. Like you said in the podcast, we kind of have to piece together her childhood, but she lost a parent young. The remaining parent was abusive. She had a child taken from her, according to her, against her will for adoption. I'm wondering if she has just a very serious personality disorder that leads to these unstable reactions and these unstable reactions to rejection, especially. So that's kind of what I was thinking last night when I was listening to that episode, is I went into it thinking this woman's a psychopath, but I left it thinking, I think there's something else going on.
You know, I spent a lot of time digging into who is Masuk, and I found out a lot of information, but I'm still kind of asking myself, who is this person? I mean, what motivates somebody to commit a crime like this? And in the benefit of hindsight, you look at this case and you're like, was she involved in this other case? I mean, is it possible? Are we looking at the right things here? I mean, I don't know. What do you think, Rabia?
Look, you know, when I listened to the 911 calls from the father and the repeated contacts he made with law enforcement, insisting that people come out, to me, that's a clear sign. I mean, that's not something most people would do if they were guilty. They would want like very low police involvement. I say that with the caveat that not everybody reacts the same in any given situation. But what I'm deeply troubled by here is that, well, we know she has the capability of committing an act like this in response to something that emotionally triggers her, a very similar trigger in both cases. But that it doesn't seem like, you know, any of the forensic evidence was tested against her. And so I would be happy to rule out somebody if you just make sure that they're also, you know, included in the pool of people who are, you know, taken through the forensic testing. And the fact that she wasn't is very problematic to me. I think she's a very, very likely suspect. And to me, I don't feel comfortable. The only circumstantial evidence tying Barton to this crime is that he was home that night, and that's just not enough. I understand that the prosecution made claims of sexual abuse, but frankly, I'm not quite sure what the evidence presented on that end was. And you know, so if I'm missing something, then maybe there's something there. But other than him being home that night, it's just not enough.
Well, it's interesting because even the prosecution now seems to have backed away from some of the forensic evidence that was presented 20 years ago. There was an enlargement of the rectum on Christina. I always feel a little bit shy about talking about this stuff on the air, but you know, this is the evidence, so we need to talk about it. But there was an enlargement in the rectum on Christina. And what forensic science has kind of learned over the last 20 years is that doesn't necessarily indicate sexual abuse at all. It's part of the rigor mortis process. The orifice just gets larger as after death. One of the prosecutions hired a new pathologist to come in and look and said, yes, but there was some sort of swelling or redness around the vulva. And that could indicate that, yeah, there was sexual abuse taking place. On the other hand, you know, the defense pathologist is saying, well, no, that doesn't necessarily mean that at all. You know, I don't know the answer to that, but we know that disproportionately sexual abuse is committed by men. But we also know that murder is disproportionately committed by men. We know that Masuk ended up becoming a murderer, so she's in that minority of murderers that are female. Could she be in that minority of sex abusers that's female? If there was sex abuse that took place, I don't know. Nobody really will know. But we don't even really know if sex abuse took place in this case. It seems very ambiguous. if I was to guess, having read the autopsy reports and interviewed folks, I think there probably was some sort of sex abuse that happened. But bottom line is, we don't know who did that. I don't think you can make an assumption, well, he's male, so, and males usually commit this crime, so it had to be him. I don't think that's an accurate assumption anymore. But I'll throw it out to the two women in this conversation. What do they think? Charlie?
I have children and three-year-olds touch themselves and will cause redness. She could have had some kind of, I don't know, she's probably potty trained, but she could still have had some kind of diaper rash or yeast infection or something. So I'd want to know that they ruled those options out for the cause of the swelling and the redness. But they can't date it. I don't know. Barton was surely not the only man in her life. I don't know. You know, she probably had uncles. She probably had grandparents. She probably had all sorts of people in her life that saying that one man, because he's a man and because he was in the house that day, had to have been the one who did it. I'm also not comfortable with that. And saying that, you know, Masuk or Barton had to have been the one sexually abusing her, I'm also not comfortable with that because, I mean, these, you can cast a kind of wide net when you really look at a child's circle. I'm just not comfortable pointing a finger at anyone for being the perpetrator of sex abuse when we don't know if it happened, and two, we don't know who else is in her circle that she sees on a regular basis.
And what do you think, Robin?
And I would add that the absence of any semen on her body, on her clothing, on her bedding, to me also, you know, I mean, like, that's the kind of evidence I would look for. And I know there's certain testing that couldn't be done maybe in the 90s that can be done today that could search for other kinds of DNA evidence that's not just semen, but even other kinds of DNA evidence that if somebody had touched her in that area recently, that would have left some kind of trace DNA to be tested. And so I hope they're able, that the Innocence Project is able to get, if those samples exist, retested to see if there's traces. I mean, if there's, but even then, I mean, like, okay, if you're a father and you're helping your three-year-old go to the restroom, there might be some trace DNA because your fingers touched her, but not inappropriately. So yeah, to me, it's not enough evidence to suggest that there was sexual abuse by anybody, to be honest. Like Charlie said, there's a number of different reasons. It could be redness or swelling.
I'm going to reveal a little bit of new information here that we haven't revealed yet in the podcast. We do know that when the Illinois Innocence Project became involved in this case, they began to look at a variety of things. And one of the things they got is some DNA testing done. Now, according to Barton McNeil, the sheets were freshly laundered. We have the receipt from where he dropped off clothing at the laundromat to be washed. Prosecutors will say, well, just because he has this receipt doesn't mean that those sheets were laundered. We just know that they he took laundry to the laundromat and picked it up. We don't know if that, those sheets were included. We do have the lab report from the Illinois State Police Crime Lab, where the lab tech says the sheets smell freshly laundered and appear clean, other than where Christina's bodily fluids had come out at postmortem. But they did some more testing, and they found Masuk's DNA on the sheets. It could be nothing. It could be significant. One of the things is they were freshly laundered sheets. Bart says she hadn't been in the house for like a week before that. Prosecutors say, well, wait a minute. Now, this is the bed where Bart usually slept. And, you know, Masuk has been his girlfriend for 3 years. Maybe something came off the mattress or something like that. It does raise some interesting questions, don't you guys think? Rabia?
This is the kind of thing that really kind of gets to me, is that you can create whatever kind of narrative you want to make excuses for the evidence, depending on where you're coming at, you know, a case from. So now you have the prosecution saying, well, sure, maybe it was her, you know, her DNA, but it came off of his body. Instead of doing the right thing and just testing everything against her, whether it's hair, fingerprints, everything, and really seriously considering these possibilities given her history now. And they know, you know, she was connected to another murder. You know, has she had a psych evaluation done? Has she been violent to other people? What is Barton McNeil's background? Has he ever, you know, been involved in hurting other children? All these things matter. And when it's deflected so easily, well, okay, so we found some DNA. I mean, that's, to me, that's significant. You have a crime lab saying they seem freshly laundered. And okay, that backs up this guy's story. I just feel like they're twisting themselves in knots to ignore a real possibility that they got it wrong.
How about you, Charlie?
I always get uncomfortable when I feel like the state is picking and choosing which evidence to weigh. So they'll dismiss this DNA stuff, but they're going to put a whole lot into some swelling on her body. And I get really uncomfortable when we start, like Robbie said, fitting the evidence to the theory rather than the other way around. And one thing in cases we've looked at is DNA is very difficult to really analyze, like do deductive reasoning with when the person is supposed to be in that space. So if there's the DNA of a wife and her husband, you know, wife goes missing and there's her DNA in her husband's trunk, well, that could have gotten there when she unloaded the groceries. You know, we can't always fit that. So I understand where the prosecution is coming from. I'm just concerned that they're so willing to just, that this gets crossed off because it doesn't fit.
This is Suspect Convictions. I'm Willis Kern along with Scott Reeder, and we're talking with our guests, Rabia Chowdhury of the podcast Undisclosed and Charlie Worrell with the Insight podcast. Upcoming during Suspect Convictions, it's your chance to question Barton McNeil about this case in an episode we're calling Ask Barton McNeil. Scott, how can listeners ask Barton McNeil a question?
They can simply send a question they really want to ask the defendant, Barton McNeil, to askbart@suspectconvictions.com, which segues right into my question for you two. If you have an opportunity to ask Barton McNeil any question, what would you ask him? How about you, Charlie?
So something that strikes me is that he didn't hear anything, and that sticks with me. I'm the primary caretaker of my children, and so I hear if they cough in the other room and it sounds a little funny, whatever I'm doing stops and I listen. So I understand that he didn't have full custody of his daughter, so maybe he wasn't as in tune to every little noise happening. But I would ask, you know, really, why did he think he didn't hear it? And I also wondered, did he leave the home at any point that evening? Did he go outside? Did he go to his car to get something? Is there any explanation for why he was one room over and didn't hear it?
Okay. Now, what he would say is he had headphones on and a fan was running in the bedroom and a fan was running in the living room where he was on the computer with his headphones on and there was no air conditioning going. It was an older apartment without air conditioning. But that's a good question. How about you, Robbie? Anything in particular come to mind?
Yeah, my understanding is that at some point after he put her to bed, put Christina to bed, he thought he did hear her talking, and he checked in on her, and it seemed like she was talking to herself and smiling. And I mean, that's what I read in one of the articles. And then he said, go back to sleep type of thing and left. And then he didn't check in on her until the next morning. My question would be, like, was that unusual behavior for her? Was that something she did normally? Or was that like an indication that maybe somebody else was in the room with her? Because if that's something his daughter did all the time, then maybe it's not unusual. But like, none of my kids do that. And if I walk into a room and they're talking kind of to themselves, sitting up, smiling, talking to themselves as she was described, I would be like, something's going on here. Something's really odd here.
Is, you know, having raised three daughters or still in the process of raising three daughters, nothing happens quietly involving a three-year-old. I mean, that's just been my experience. I mean, I have three really loud children. I mean, especially when they were three. Where I struggle here is, could somebody come through that window stealthily and then suffocate a three-year-old in such a manner that it wouldn't wake up the whole neighborhood? When one of my kids stubs their toe in the middle of the night, the whole house hears it.
Well, I'll be honest. Look, I have two daughters. I have a son now. Both my daughters, my oldest daughter was very, very quiet. very quiet. And my second daughter, who's 9, is much more precocious and assertive, but she also gets frightened very easily. And I've seen them both in situations where they got scared and they just froze. So not all kids are the same, I would say. And if it was somebody talking to her that she knew, you know, who said, shh, don't tell anybody here, it's a secret, it's a game. Like, I can totally see one of my daughters at that age having, like, played that game. And to smother a child, I mean, I don't know how she was, but I assume with a pillow or something, how could...
They think that she was face down into the mattress is the way it was done. Yeah. Just horrible.
I think it could be done without a sound having escaped her because of the way she was killed.
So
maybe she would have kicked and moved, but maybe not been able to scream.
We haven't talked about the window evidence. I mean, that's something that the defense has hung a lot of their case on. You know, the screens were cut right above the latches where you can unhook the window and enter. Prosecution seems very dismissive of this. We don't know when those screens were cut, but it doesn't matter when the screens were cut. The fact that they were cut and there was accessibility, I mean, does this raise a red flag for either of you?
Yeah, I think that the window was accessible from the outside to open it rather quietly, that really does matter because there's a huge question of how could someone have gotten in here? Well, now here's the defense saying, here's how someone could have gotten in here. The cobweb stuff and all that, nobody can really say for sure any of that. But accessibility, someone being able to get in that home and hurt the child is the entire alternative theory. And so we can't dismiss it. It's the defense's case.
How about you, Rabia?
No, I think that's evidence you have to consider in this case. And if it was cut in the places that would give access to the latches, you know, there might be evidence on the outside of that window frame. How was it cut? Like, what was the tool used to cut it? Look for that. Just the fact that it wasn't investigated to me is a big gaping hole in the whole case. I think it was. I think the police, whether or not they got it right, they got their investigation wrong.
Well, let me ask you this, Robbie. You're an attorney. One of the things that struck me is, I didn't say odd, but interesting, is that the defense attorney in this case asked for a bench trial rather than a jury trial, and they didn't present any expert witnesses in the case at all. In fact, the only defense witness was Barton McNeil himself. Does this strike you as a good trial strategy to go with a bench trial in a case like this?
I mean, from a defense perspective, unless you have an incredibly airtight case, I would never be comfortable with a bench trial. And in a situation like this where, while I don't know if there was a lot of evidence to convict, I don't know if there's, I mean, look, yeah, ideally innocent until proven guilty. That's really not how the system works. On some level, defendant has to prove his innocence. And not being able to prove your innocence puts you in a really precarious position. Going with a jury trial, I mean, you have 12 shots. You know, you have 12 shots. You just need one person to say, nope, I don't believe it, I'm not buying it, to get a hung jury. I think it was a poor trial strategy. And then you have the issues with, I mean, this judge ruling that no other alternative evidence could have come in about the other suspect. It was poorly calculated. I was very surprised with that decision. I don't know. Maybe there was a reason for it. Maybe this attorney knew the judge had a certain record on these kinds of cases and relied on that. Or they thought that their defendant would play really poorly in front of a jury. I mean, we also remember, I think it was like the 80s, 90s, there was many, many cases involving false confessions even, but false accusations of child molestation and daycares and all kinds of things. And, you know, also the satanic fervor was around. So there might have been reasons he thought, I don't want to put this guy in front of a jury. He's a single dad. There's a lot out there that prejudices people to begin with. And but I just think you have 12 shots when you have jury.
When I read the transcripts, there's no evidence rebutting any of the expert testimony. And obviously, the Innocence Project has been able to find expert witnesses to rebut the testimony 20 years later. Why couldn't the public defender handling this case 20 years ago find expert witnesses to rebut it. Why wasn't that presented in that mix? And it really raises some red flags for me. I mean, I'm just kind of asking myself, I don't know. I mean, it just seems to me to be a strange thing. You have some experience with public defenders. Rabia, do you have any thoughts on why that might have been?
Look, public defenders are notoriously overworked. And I think, you know, again, I know nothing about this attorney. I know nothing about his caseload, his or her caseload, about how they did another trials. I mean, I'm surprised, like, you know, maybe in a lot of cases like this, you know, public defenders will, and private attorneys will seek a plea deal because they want to avoid a trial. And also because they don't have time for so many trials. Take a long, long time. It takes a long time to prepare. Public defenders have very low resources. They don't have tens of thousands of dollars to hire experts. And they also have to kind of prioritize, you know, with the limited resources where they're going to use them for their different cases. So it's hard to kind of blame a PD in a situation where they're just really strapped for time and resources, but maybe could have done a better job on trial strategy if they were going to go that way.
One of the ways I think the public defender was also kind of just set up for failure is that unless, you know, Michael Peterson, we watched The Staircase, and he has this whole team of lawyers who have their own investigators who are investigating the case themselves and rerunning evidence. The public defender can't do any of that. They're almost entirely reliant on the police investigation. And if the police aren't testing things and the state's not testing it and then turning it over, the public defender has very little to work with except what the state chooses to provide.
Obviously, the current state's attorney was not in this office 20 years ago. The assistants now working this case were not in the office when this case was prosecuted. Have you noticed, Rabia, a reticence, though, for prosecutors to admit that perhaps a colleague or a predecessor made a mistake just because they're in the same position that's now being held?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there is like the thing about inertia when it comes to the law and legal process is that it's very carefully guarded and fostered. Finality of convictions, precedents, like people in the legal world don't want things to change. It's a cultural issue in many ways. You have the rebels who every so often you'll hear of a DA who's come in and said, there was a problem in this maybe era or during the time of this, you know, detective on a certain beat and we're going to review all these cases. Those prosecutors are considered like just kind of these, you know, heroes and rebels in the criminal justice community because they're so rare. And, you know, right now I'm really interested in seeing what happens in Philadelphia because of the very recent election of Larry Krasner, who is a lifelong criminal defense attorney and civil rights attorney and had sued the Philadelphia Police Department 75 times. He just won. He is now the top prosecutor in Philadelphia beginning January. And he has promised to turn that office on its head and you know, change things that have been the same for decades. And it's about time. And I hope to see that kind of, I guess, revolution in a way in a lot of different jurisdictions. But that is the status quo, preserving a conviction, keeping those notches on belts. And these communities, like you said, I mean, like they go on to really take care of themselves. You have these prosecutors become judges, right? So if you have a new prosecutor come in, well, that old prosecutor could be in still a position of leverage over that new prosecutor because maybe they're a judge now or what have you. And they also have to work with police officers. They have to work with other colleagues who you tick off the wrong person. It could hurt how your work gets done.
I'm going to ask you the big question. If you guys were sitting on the jury on this case, with the evidence that's been presented so far in the podcast that you've heard, is there reasonable doubt?
I mean, for me, beyond a doubt, there's reasonable doubt. If you cannot prove to me that he killed this child with the evidence necessary, then that is reasonable doubt.
I agree with Rabia. I feel like they haven't proved beyond a reasonable doubt that he did it. Now, he has a hard time explaining things, but that's not how it's supposed to work. They're supposed to prove it. And because they failed to test things that would rule out that doubt. If they tested the windowsill outside, if they did some other tests, then, or, you know, maybe question Masuk a little longer, I think they didn't prove the case because they didn't even look for enough evidence.
Now, of course, what you'd hear from a prosecutor is, yeah, obviously we proved the case. He was found guilty. So we did the case was proven. He was found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, once somebody's convicted, the presumption is of guilt, not of innocence. Do you think that the evidence that's been presented so far by the Illinois Innocence Project has been sufficient to override that presumption of guilt?
You know, they have a real uphill battle right now because, you know, part of the issue is going to be at least, and I don't know exactly under Illinois law how it goes, but generally speaking, to get in front of a judge again on a case like this, you can't just say there were things that could have been done that weren't done. It has to rise to the level of like new evidence that could not have been found at the time. But I mean, I, in this case, would try to find separate evidence, meaning, you know, do more investigation, really, really intense investigation to Masuk's whereabouts that night, see if she talked to other people, see if they can get independent testing done. But it has to be really new evidence.
Any thoughts, Charlie?
One thing that I've definitely learned through, you know, researching podcasting and reading appeals documents is that that bar is really high. I've read appeals documents where it pretty much says, oh, yeah, they did this and this was wrong, but it probably wouldn't have changed things enough.
Thanks to each of our guests today, Rabia Chowdhury of the podcast Undisclosed and Charlie Worrell with the Insight Podcast. Upcoming during Suspect Convictions, it's your chance to question Barton McNeil about this case in an episode we're calling Ask Barton McNeil. To submit your question for this episode, send an email to askbart@suspectconvictions.com. That's askbart@suspectconvictions.com. Next week, we delve into the murder which landed Bart's girlfriend, Masuk, in prison. A look at the death of her mother-in-law, Linda Tida.
Her claim was that it was self-defense, that they had a fight, and that she had no choice but to strangle her mother-in-law in order to defend herself.
That's next week during Suspect Convictions. Special thanks to Colin Thompson, WGLT General Manager R.C. McBride, and the production staff of Sound Ideas, including Mike McCurdy, Charlie Schlenker, and Ryan Denham. With investigative journalist and Suspect Convictions creator Scott Reeder, I'm Willis Kern. We'll see you next week on Suspect Convictions. Suspect Convictions each week during Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from the Bloomington Normal Economic Development Council, hosting Be and By the Numbers, a quarterly update on McLean County's economic progress on Thursday, December 14th at Illinois State University's Bone Student Center Prairie Room from 11:30 to 1. More information at bnbiz.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This week on This American Life, one of our producers, Karen, talks with a friend of hers from church who also was one of the most notorious burglars in the history of San Francisco. Like, at the same time. He'd drop into stores from the ceiling. Police called him Spider-Man.
I can't think of a single place that I wanted to get into that I couldn't get into.
Needy superheroes. This week. Tomorrow at noon on GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from Justin M. Boyd, country financial representative proud to serve you from his new office in historic downtown Bloomington. Justin offers life insurance options to protect your family and leave a lasting legacy. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas Monday on the show. An ISU expert on state and local government says the proposal to strip Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner's agenda-setting power might or might not be legal,
but it's certainly a bad idea.
You know, Mayor Renner should have the power to add items to the agenda. You know, he represents the whole city and nobody else does.
Lori Riverstone Newell talks city government and structure plus politics on Sound Ideas Monday at noon and 6 on GLT. I'm Mike McCurdy. The people in this year's Multicultural Leadership Program class say they're not only learning project management and helping the community, they're on an introspective journey of self-discovery. The class is connected with 5 nonprofits which are looking for help with outreach, events, and marketing. In advance of the project's midterm reports, GLT correspondent Colleen Reynolds caught up with one group helping the Illinois Heart and Lung Foundation develop a one-day summer camp for kids to reduce the number of medical visits for asthma attacks.
It was 13:45.
Okay. Yeah, I know. We
a little bit of time to shave off. Totally normal at the practice point.
The 5 groups doing community service projects get feedback as they practice for a mid-project presentation. Kathy Franklin of Illinois Heart and Lung is excited to have help from her group, which is coming up with a plan for a one-day asthma camp for kids 12 and under to learn their triggers and how to manage their disease while having fun.
They're looking at different camps across the nation and saying, how has it been done before? How can we do it here? To have this group come together and do it, we could not do it without them because it is a lot of hours.
So I caught up with Team Awesome, made up of Reagan Ranchuso, Troy Clark, Beth Marsh, Anita Jarum, and Carol Carlson, who unfortunately couldn't stick around after practice. Reagan begins by talking about the task of putting together a one-day asthma camp.
My connection personally is that I have asthma myself, so I do have a little bit of an insight on kind of some of the things that children with asthma have to deal with from time to time.
I'm going to turn things over to Troy and ask, how did you begin to attack the project?
Working with Kathy Franklin, we really honed in on what she was hoping to accomplish, and it's really to help educate and arm children who have asthma so they can better prepare for it, and also they can have a good time. So knowing that, then we looked at the project, looked at our timelines and what we would need to do to develop that plan and the tools and the materials that the IHLF would need to put on such a program. I think everything from surveys and registration materials, promotional materials, volunteers. So we've got a whole 6-month plan lined out and we're doing pretty good. We've talked to a lot of people about what the needs are for this target audience and what we hope to accomplish with that.
Beth, did you sort of divide up duties?
So our project is broken down primarily in 5 phases, and coincidentally there are 5 team members. So each team member is primarily responsible for one of the phases. I'll be identifying how many volunteers we'll need, what type of volunteers. We'll need some medical professionals as well as some civilian volunteers as well, and then what their roles and responsibilities will be.
Reagan, how did you decide who will do what?
I think our team actually has worked really well together because things just kind of fell into areas that people were willing and enthusiastic about working on. Troy and I have a little bit of a background with marketing, and so we know when it comes to that phase that we'll probably take point on it. There is another member of our team, Carol, who is really adept at research. She's a faculty member, so she's doing a lot of the primary research and surveying of people. So just kind of naturally, I think, for our team maybe more than others, kind of fell into what we all felt comfortable tackling and dividing it up that way.
So that brings me to my next question. Anita, talk a little bit about any of the challenges that you've had.
Identifying the right people that we need to contact and reaching out to them. And sometimes it's not easy to reach them via phone or email or anything like that. So we have to find the right mode to reach them at the right time.
So I wanted to point something out. We're not just working on this project for the IHLF. We're also developing our leadership skills, our collaboration skills, and kind of finding out where our strengths are and where our weaknesses are. And I think we talked a little bit about the challenges within the project, and a lot of teams have personality or who gets to be in charge. The wonderful thing about this group of folks, it really has gone very smoothly. We recognize the problems, we recognize the conflicts, and we work through them very well. And I think that's a testament to us. And I think we're also learning stuff within the program that we are applying as we work together.
And Beth, you did not necessarily as a group determine that somebody was going to be the project leader?
So the first day, once we found out what our project was, we discussed the possibility of having a project manager. We decided at that moment that we weren't going to pick anyone for that role. We have discussed it periodically since then, but really we've all kind of taken our own turn in leading the project, depending on what phase we're on, what part of the phase, who has some extra capacity outside of their day job, and have done the project manager role more organically that way.
Reagan, I think some people would be really surprised to hear that. It sounds like it could be a recipe for disaster, but so far it's working. Why do you think that is?
I don't know that we thought that we would be this lucky to have this non-leadership group work the way it has, but it's just kind of worked out that we haven't all been like crazy busy in our own jobs at the same time, which has been beneficial. Like I had a couple extra hours one week and I worked ahead on some stuff. And then this last week I was kind of buried and some other people took on a little bit more of the workload. And at any point when we feel like it's not working, that we don't have one point person, we can rethink that.
Troy, I'm going to follow up on something you said. There are some things we're learning that we are applying. Can you give me an example?
Sure. We recently had a program where we talked about the hidden privileges, the white privilege, and the various power stages that people are in, unrecognized. You may not know it. And so it really caused me to kind of, okay, how am I reacting to something that Beth may have with her kids, right? Because I don't have kids. So areas where I might take things for granted, I've learned to stop myself and go, okay, am I reacting this way because I don't understand or because I think I deserve more? I'm also the one male in a group of five very strong women. So they keep me in check as well. We've learned about asserting ourselves, about leadership courage, and that's a really important thing. Being able to speak our minds and knowing that no one's going to hold that against us, I think has been a really important part for that collaboration and that everybody leads when they can feel comfortable to lead.
Anita, you seem a little more soft-spoken, and this seems like an outgoing group. Have you found your voice, and do you feel like you've been able to be heard?
I think for me, I work on the principle that you don't have to be a lion to roar. Like, you can still be soft and still get your point out. And I think with this group, even though we are soft, I'm soft-spoken, I'm still able to voice my opinions and it's been heard. So I feel quite comfortable about that. Maybe it's a little bit softer, but still it gets through. So
we do have another team member who isn't here right now, Carol, and she is a introvert. She has had some of those challenges, and she actually presented to our larger group last week that one of the aha moments that she had was she was very happy that she was able to say, hey, I want to finish my thought before we veer on into something else. And that's not something that is comfortable for her. And so she was really happy to discover that she was able to take those skills, like that self-discovery and those leadership skills, and use that in a real situation.
Final question, and I'm going to start with you, Anita. What are your thoughts about this program and what it is giving you and teaching you?
It's helped me to understand what the concept of servant leadership is and to apply that not only in my organization that I work in, but also in community, how to make myself a good leader by serving others.
Beth, have you learned anything about yourself through this?
For myself personally, I feel more confident in my leadership abilities. I've learned more about my strengths, and I've also learned how sometimes my strengths can be a little too strong and have learned opportunities to dial them back, which has served me very well in my day job, as well as I think on this project team.
Just a quick follow-up, strengths that are too strong.
So I have a strength of woo, which is a desire to kind of make friends with everyone in the room. And I think at times that desire can overtake what the goal of our meeting is or what the goal of our get together is. And so I need to be conscious of that and dial it back a bit.
So I think that there's definitely been an increase in self-awareness. The best thing I think from the group is really getting the opportunity to work with the people I'm getting to work with. This team is awesome, which is our nickname, and just getting the chance to meet them, to get to know them better, to make those friendships, both out in this group and with the entire people in the program, has been probably one of the best things about this, in addition to all of the learning about the community and the philanthropy.
And Reagan, you have served in leadership roles in other organizations. So what's different about this, and what have you learned about yourself?
I think one of the big surprises was I was expecting to learn leadership skills and how leadership skills can benefit your organization and all those things. I wasn't expecting the introspective part part of MCLP. I don't know if I'm alone in that. I'm seeing some head shaking, so it sounds like everybody's kind of agreeing with that. Because first you have to know where you come from, to know how you can use your style and your skills and your strengths to be the best leader. So we spent a lot of time learning our strengths. We did the Strength Finder, learning our Myers-Briggs, several indications like that, and then our privilege. We kind of identified what our privileges are that we don't think about. So there's a lot of that, and it really is infused in everything you do as an employee, as a leader, as a friend, as a colleague. So that has been something that I wasn't expecting. And sometimes it's hard. It's hard to look inside sometimes, but I think it's been very beneficial as well. And the relationships, the people that I've met, my mentor that's been assigned to me is fabulous. Sonia Reese, she's taken me under her wing and she's introduced me to a lot of people because I am terrible at networking. I don't like doing it, but she's kind of forced me out of that comfort zone, and we've attended a lot of things and seen a lot of people.
Thank you very much for your thoughts and reflections, and best of luck on your presentation. I'm Colleen Reynolds.
If you're interested in seeing the MCLP Community Service presentations, the sessions are open to the public from 8:30 to 10:30 Saturday morning at the IAA building on Towanda Avenue in Bloomington.
One, two, three, four.
For choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal and WGLT.org. Our website is where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast and the individual stories and interviews today from Scott Reeder, Willis Kern, and Colleen Reynolds. Let us know what you think of Sound Ideas or Suspect Convictions. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Our email address is news@WGLT.org. Tweet about the show. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News. I'm at Mike McCurdy. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.